Right now, it is time to bring in Arthur Schwartz, the food maven. Arthur, of course, joins us on a Monday morning. And what do we talk about? We talk about food. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning. I'm actually in mourning today. Good morning. 21 closed, and I was genuinely saddened by this news. You know, 21 is, it started out as a speakeasy it's the address. Yeah. Did you know that? That's why it's called 21, because it's 21 West 52nd Street. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things about this that sadden me and make me wonder. Let me start with the wonder. I remember years ago, the owners, who were not the original owners, or maybe it was, I don't think so, sold the air rights over these two brownstones on 52nd Street. They're probably, I haven't looked in a while, but they're probably the only two brownstones left on 52nd Street. This was at one time a brownstone street. And, in fact, it was known as a speakeasy street. There was 38 speakeasies on 52nd Street between 5th and 6th. And, in fact, there were so many speakeasies that the one woman who lived in a brownstone, which was not a speakeasy, had to put a sign on her door saying, this is a private residence. Do not knock. So the buildings are there. I mean, this is not like they have a lease on it. The big company that owns it, I'm pretty sure owns the buildings. So they say they're going to do something, but I don't know. 21 legendary restaurants, some legendary food, believe it or not, although we never associate 21 with food. And if, in case you're really curious after this, it's a big essay in my book, Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food, which I never plug, but I probably should, because I'm looking at it this morning for that reason, to see what I had to say here, and also to see if the picture I was hoping to be here was here. And the subtitle is An Opinionated History and More Than 100 Legendary Recipes. And I have noticed lately that it started out, I don't know how many years ago, I wrote this at least 10, 15 years ago. Original price was $45. I saw it for $8, the hardcover. And there is a soft cover as well, still in print. I must say, I am prouder of this book today than I was when it was published. But anyway, I can go on and on about my book. But all about 21 is in here. And 21... was actually the brainchild of cousins Jack Krindler and Charlie Burns. They were not only cousins, but they were pals. And Krindler was at Fordham University Pharmacy School, and Burns was studying business at NYU. And they had an uncle, Sam. No joke, Uncle Sam. Yeah. Who did own a bar on the Lower East Side when alcohol was legal, and now was making big money with a speakeasy in Greenwich Village, and they needed tuition money. These boys came from the Lower East Side, poor boys in tenements. So they opened a place of their own. They figured, well, if Uncle Sam can do this, we can do this. And they called it the Redhead, also in the Village. It was on 6th Avenue in Washington Place. Years later, there was something called the Redhead, but it had no relation to this, because they didn't last there very long. They sold their illegal booze in dollar-an-ounce flasks, and then the customers would pour it into a teacup. You've seen that in the movies. People during Prohibition were drinking booze out of teacups. So the funny part of all of this is that the mother, I forget the mother of which one, I'm sure it's in this essay, actually helped them out because, you know, she wanted the kid to go to college too. So she made the booze in the tenement department. She made the booze that they sold. So after a year, they had to move. They lost their lease. It's interesting, you know, much later, like in the 1970s, Joe Baum, a very famous great restaurateur, said, a great restaurant is one that lasts its lease. So, kudos to 21. They lasted 90 years at that location. This is prior to 1930 when they opened on 52nd Street at 88 Washington Place. They called it the Club Fronton. I have no idea what that was supposed to mean. The bar, it was just a plank of wood. It wasn't even a bar, held up by sawhorses. And they only had four kinds of booze. I have to say, in those days, there wasn't much else. Scotch, bourbon, rye, and gin. And nobody drank vodka until the 1950s, at least. And they had a drain in the floor. So if they got raided, they could pour everything down the drain. And of course, they had a peephole, you know, and they did get raided. I mean, people got raided. And they, as you saw seen in the movies, it was a peephole, so that if somebody knocked or rang, whatever, they could look out and see who wanted to come in. By the way, very famous people would go to speakeasies. I mean, really respectable people. The mayor himself, Jimmy Walker, was known to frequent speakeasies. But of course, nobody wanted to get caught, so they had all these ways of hiding what they were doing. Let's say that. So by this time, 1926-27, Crinler gave up on pharmacy because he was making so much money selling his mother's illegal booze. And they all opened a bar. And by the way, though, Burns did graduate from NYU Business School. They opened at 42 West 28th Street. This was right near Rockefeller. But then they got torn down because Rockefeller Center came. And everything got demolished for Rockefeller Center. And finally, in 1930, they moved to 21 West 52nd Street. As I said, there were already a bunch of speakeasies on that block. And what's interesting to me, I hope to you, is that a lot of these speakeasies didn't become restaurants like 21 did, but became jazz clubs in the 1930s, and it is now officially known, this stretch of 52nd Street, as Swing Street. So if you ever wondered why 52nd between 5th and 6th is called Swing Street, it's because the speakeasies evolved into jazz clubs, and now they're evolved into high-rise buildings. But anyway, Crinler and Burns moved for other reasons as well, and the primary reason is they could buy the building. And they decided after three different locations where they rented and lost their locations, they were going to settle down in their own property. I know this, you know, even today, I have friends in this position who were renters and with their business and then said, that's the end of it. I only move if I can buy the building. So they did. And those buildings, of course, that's why they're still there. Now, the booze at 21, to hide it from the feds, was kept in a bank vault in the basement of the building. And the bank vault itself was camouflaged with a brick wall. And from the outside of the brick wall to the lock inside of this bank vault was 18 inches. So the only way to open this was you had to know how and where. For that matter, because it was totally camouflaged. Now, I have been privy to this room many times. At some point, I don't remember exactly when, they turned the wine cellar into a private dining room. And not only did I go to parties there a couple times, but I have toured the cellar a number of times. And the one picture I was looking for in my book is here. is that in this wine cellar, I don't know what's happening now, is the stock of some very rich, important people, including Richard Nixon. So I have a picture in my book of it says private stock of this is the end of the bottle. The bottle is in a rack, and it says private. It's a red label, private stock of President Nixon, Jack and Charlie's 21. By the way, I know people call it 21 Club or the Club 21, or the word club gets in there, but it was never a club. It was never a private club. People called it that because it was exclusive, because you had to be rich, not so much famous. All you needed was, this is New York, all you need is money. Nobody cares if your mother was a laundress. As long as you've got the bucks to pay for 21, you're welcome. So 21 became an exclusive club because you had to be rich to go there. And by the way, they had a marketing policy. If anybody had a more expensive hamburger, they raised the price on theirs. And this has just happened this morning because I thought, well, I should, as any modern person does, I went on the Internet to see what I could find about the closing of 21. Not much there, by the way. And I did discover a menu. There's still a menu online for 21, and the hamburger was $31 on the menu. But then I also read a little in one of the news articles about its closing. It pointed out that Trump celebrated his victory in 2016 with his family at 21, and he ordered a $36 hamburger. So from the time this, unless, you know, maybe for Trump at a table with his family, it was $36, because the $31 hamburger was on the bar menu that I found online. By the way, I do know that there is a more expensive hamburger. I think Daniel Ballou was charging 40-something for his hamburger, but it's stuffed with foie gras, so that's different. By the way, if you have my book, Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food, besides seeing this wine and a door to the wine cellar, there's a picture of me standing at the bar. Now, this was not a bar that you stood at to have a drink. This was a service bar, and it faced the dining room. The main clubby, if I can say clubby, the room that special people were put in, if there were any special people around to be put in there. People, by the way, people who you wouldn't, not necessarily celebrities, they were often, you know, in the industry moguls. And in fact, if you look at this picture, you can see, I'm sure there are better pictures of this, but... I may even have some. You'll see the ceiling of this room is festooned. Oh, I didn't know I could use festooned in a sentence. Festooned with corporate toys and other things that have corporate logos on them. When I say corporate toys, I mean like toy airplanes with corporate logos on them. Or other macho kind of things, like you'd find in a teenager's room. But here it is at Adult 21. Table service was always great, even when the food wasn't. And there were dishes here that I used to go for. And chief among them was steak tartare. It was like the only place I trusted to eat raw meat. And Steak Diane. Now, Steak Diane was not created at 21, but back in the 70s and 80s, like my time, it was the only restaurant in town that made Steak Diane. And not only that, they made it tableside. So I have the recipe, but I made it so often back when I was right after this book was published, I was still making it, that I bought a special pan to make it in. I figured I deserved it. It's the same pan that you will see in the photograph of Steak Diane in the book. And but it's not me cooking it. That this is done at the restaurant, and you can see the prep for the sauce is there, and you have the very iconic, I'm using the word properly, as people do not these days, iconic tablecloth from 21, which they used until, and they're probably still on the tables as we speak, waiting to open again. But anyway, Steak Diane is nothing but, and by the way, we don't know who Diane is. I have really thoroughly researched this. I cannot find any information about Diane herself. However, supposedly the dish was created at the Drake Hotel. And it was a popular dish, by the way, in all the so-called Cafe Society restaurants. And one reason is it's flambéed at the table. And in those days, that show was very important. So it's nothing but a thin steak, a mediocre, a mediocre supermarket steak will do in this case, because you're going to glop it up with sauce in the end. And you can even take your good normal 16-ounce boneless shell and just cut it into two thinner steaks, and salt and pepper them well. And by the way, this is all done on top of the stove. And the pan that I bought is a crepe pan, like crepe Suzette pan. It's a shallow, very shallow, and wide a pan. Mine's copper, like the one in the picture. But you don't need this. Any big skillet will do. So you cut the steak horizontally. These days, steaks are pretty well trimmed, but if it's not, you can trim off some of the outside fat. Just that. Leave a tiny bit, though. And salt and pepper generously. And then add a tablespoon of butter to a heated skillet, and as soon as the foam melts and the foam subsides, add your meat and cook each side for just a minute. You're only doing a primary or preliminary cooking here. So literally a meat, 1 minute over relatively high heat, and then remove the meat to a plate. And, oh, I should start by saying, as in the picture, you should really have this all prepped ahead of time, because once the meat is cooked, you just want to do it, and get it done with. So what you need for the sauce that you should have prepared ahead, besides the tablespoon of butter, and you're going to want another tablespoon, by the way, another tablespoon later, 3 tablespoons, a significant amount, of finely minced shallots, and then prepare for yourself 6 ounces, a third of a cup, of cognac. 2 tablespoons. Don't mix these liquids, because you're going to only use half. Well, you could if you want to use half the cognac, and you can mix that with 2 tablespoons of dry white wine. Then you also want to have a couple teaspoons of Dijon mustard. In my book, I say preferably imported, and you know I mean that. And I've been buying because there's some Dijon made in the U.S. that's just too mild, doesn't really do what I want it to. But there is some, I noticed, there are some Dijon mustards being made in Canada, and they're much zingier. So if it's not French, it should be Canadian. And believe it or not, A1 sauce. Now, A1 sauce was a big deal ingredient in the 1920s. 2 tablespoons of A1 steak sauce. Yes, I would go out and buy a bottle of A1 steak sauce, because once you've made this, you're probably going to make it again and again, especially for mediocre supermarket steaks. And a couple tablespoons of heavy cream. I'm just telling you all this because it's all got to go into the pan pretty quickly. And this is garnished with chives, but you can leave that out, although I don't. 2 tablespoons of finely snipped chives. Snipped, I use a scissor to cut them. Anyway, as soon as those steaks have cooked 1 minute per side, increase the heat a little bit, add your cognac, flambé. It probably is going to flame up on its own. Add the wine. Keep on stirring with a wooden spoon. And you might have a little brown glaze on the bottom from cooking the steaks. Immediately stir in your mustard and A1 sauce. And mix and cook this liquid just for a minute or two to get it syrupy. And then add a half a cup of beef broth. And continue to cook it. Now, this is all done at the table at 21, or was. And got to say, every waiter had his own little way of doing it, and then used more or less this or more or less that. So I say, you know, go for it if you want to add or subtract. Anyway, add the cream. Now, I use more than 2 tablespoons of cream. I know from experience, I don't know why this recipe only calls for 2 tablespoons, but it's a little stingy. So put in your cream. Taste for seasoning, meaning salt and pepper. And now you can use the remaining cognac to flame it up again. But you don't have to. So that's why I said 3 tablespoons of cognac in the sauce, and then you reserve 3 if you want to. I tip the pan a tiny bit and put the cognac at the edge of the pan, and it'll flame up. Stir in your chives, again, salt and pepper, and that's it. To put your steaks in there, turn them in the sauce a few times as the sauce simmers, and it really is delicious. As I say, it improves a supermarket steak, and at least I used to think so. Now it improves most steak. So I like this with mashed potatoes, as you can imagine.
Oh, that's what better combination is there?
You could have rice.
No. Maybe with peppered steak we could have rice, but not that.
So the other recipe that, besides steak tartare, the other dish, that Bob Harnett always ordered this at 21, chicken hash. And this was a popular item at 21. I'm sure they couldn't take it off the menu, even though its fans are probably in their 90s by now. But chicken hash wasn't hash at all. It was chicken and cream sauce. And in the end of the 19th century until the 1950s, I would say, maybe even beyond, chicken in some kind of cream sauce was a really big deal thing. Not only in restaurants, but in the 1950s, of course, it became a horrible thing as it was made with, you know, canned cream of this and that, and became what we were all served in high school cafeterias as chicken a la king. But the real chicken a la king, the recipe for which is also in Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food, was invented in Brooklyn at the Brighton Beach Hotel, and owner's name was Keen, and somehow it became chicken a la king. And it's a really good version of creamed chicken.
We used to get that at Sharon Center School. They used to, when we used to cook real meals back then, 2 scoops of rice that were out of an ice cream scooper, and then they'd put the chicken a la king on top of it. To this day, I love chicken a la king
chicken a la king too, and I make it from time to time. And I do use the recipe that's in New York City Food. When I say 100 legendary recipes, you've heard of almost all of these things that are in the book, but you just never thought to make them. But why not? Sardi's cannelloni. Now, will Sardi's close? I have this. I worry about this. I'm so fond of Sardi's. The food goes up and down, but Sardi's is, you know, Sardi's. It's plastered with all these celebrity caricatures. The whole story of Sardi's is in my book, too, and the recipe for the cannelloni. And here's something I was actually thinking about making the other day, because we're eating too much red meat, and these are the Stork Club's chicken burgers. Gotta say, it's another version of chicken and cream sauce. But in this case, they're chicken burgers. with lots of butter and cream. Very keto diet, got to say. And, you know, there's a new biography of James Beard, and it focuses on his homosexuality. And not many people knew that he actually had a very long-term partner named Gino Cofacci. And Gino lived upstairs in the Beard, in the, what is now called the Beard House, when James Beard actually bought that brownstone on 12th Street. I knew him before he owned that brownstone. He lived in another brownstone. It wasn't actually a brownstone, but another townhouse in Greenwich Village. In any case, Gino lived upstairs, and Gino was famous for this dacquoise, this hazelnut chocolate dacquoise, which, when I go off my diet, may be the first thing I may make. It's a mocha buttercream with chocolate icing, and the layers of, as in a dacquoise, are meringue. And, in fact, Gino sold this cake to two restaurants, and you may remember eating it at the Coach House, which, last time I looked, was the Mario Batali restaurant, which I'm forgetting. Who knows if that'll ever open again. And to a man named Alfredo Viazzi, who had a restaurant called Trattoria da Alfredo in Greenwich Village. I loved this place, as did James Beard himself. And, in fact, I ate there with James Beard a few times. And it was one of the rages of New York. If you want, this is, if for all you bakers out there, this is probably, there are a number of good baked goods in the book, but this may be one of the best. Gino Cofacci's Mocha Dacquoise.
All right.
Anyway, I'm prouder of my book today than I was then. And I have to tell you that besides beautiful on-site photographs and food photographs, a small part of my New York restaurant postcard collection is in this book. So. You know, if you're old, you'll remember a lot of it. It's a history book, so it ends in the 80s.
Right. Now, when you mentioned about the different hash, there was used to be a restaurant that's no longer open here called the Old Drover's Inn. On Route 22.
I remember the Old Drover's Inn.
They had a spectacular dish that I had. Whenever I went there, I had it. Their brown turkey hash with mustard sauce.
Well, I wonder if I couldn't find that, because Old Drover's was such a famous restaurant, and it was called an inn. And I do have some old books that collect recipes from around the country and in places like the Old Drover's. Let me see what it was called what?
It's called brown turkey hash with mustard sauce. It is if you Google brown turkey hash with mustard sauce, Old Drover's Inn, it'll pop up. The recipe will pop up.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. But it's just something that I remember when you mentioned the hash.
Well, I make it.
Yeah, I tried. I can't make it like I did. It didn't come out the same way. I'll just keep the memory of it.
Well, another recipe, by the way, I was supposed to be making this for Thanksgiving with my little great nieces. We were going to make popovers together. I do have the recipe from Patricia Murphy's in the book. I have to say, it's a pretty standard recipe, but she actually had the recipe on the cocktail napkins at the restaurant, so it was not a hard recipe to get.
All right.
Yeah. Anyway, I could go on, as I did in this book. I'd like to sell a few books. I don't get any royalties up to this at this point, but it's still always nice to sell a few books.
Well, I want you to have a Merry Christmas, and of course, we'll have the New Year's edition leading up to New Year's next week.
Yes. I'm home alone for New Year's. About you, not alone. I have Bob here, but yeah, it's going to be a lonely New Year.
Well,
I shouldn't say that. We never go out on New
Year's. That's right.
No, but we are terribly missing our family in Philly. So my nephew who's on the front lines as a doctor got his vaccine last week. My niece, who's not quite front lines as a doctor, is getting hers this week. And now I hear that old folks like Bob and me can get ours very soon. So we should be okay.
All right. Well, I want you to have a good week, and we'll speak to you next week, Arthur.
All right. You too.
Take care,
everyone.
Bye-bye. Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio. You can find Arthur on the web at robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, the food maven with Arthur Schwartz. Underwriting support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. And on the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, rubiners.com. Hillsdale Home Chef, more information, 518-325-7000, hgshomechef.com.